Thank you. I bragged to Chuck earlier about being an Aggie and being able to figure out all this stuff that we might have to do tonight with the PowerPoint and microphone and whatnot. Hopefully that won't blow up in my face. But we're looking in Judges 13, and we're going to be looking briefly through Judges 13 through 16 at the life of Samson, who, as Brother Durham mentioned a moment ago, I think rogue character might be a good way of describing Samson. When we look very far into the life of this man, he is one of the most puzzling inclusions in Hebrews chapter 11. When we look at the details of his life, we see what he did, we see what he was up to. In short order, you kind of find yourself wondering, how did he make the cut? What was it that he did that would make him worthy of being included alongside men like Abraham, and Moses, and Noah? Men of shining example, men of tremendous faith and character. How does Samson fit into that picture? The story that we read of him does begin in Judges 13, and I'm not going to read very much from this text. I'm going to rely a little bit on your familiarity with his story and your ability to just kind of skim through some of these verses as we're looking at them. Chapter 13 finds, in fact, Samson's parents being told of his birth. Already before the man himself is on the scene, there's a lot of expectations set up for Samson. An angel tells about his birth. He is to live under this Nazarite vow from the moment he is born. He is not to consume anything that has grown on the vine. He is not to come into contact with any dead bodies, anything that would impurify him in that way. He is not, most importantly and most famously perhaps, he is not to cut his hair. But after Samson is born in chapter 14, he immediately begins making some decisions which are perhaps troubling to us, because he goes and finds a wife from among the daughters of the Philistines. Finds a woman who, he says in his own words, is pleasing to his eye. He just finds someone that looks good and decides that this will be the woman he wants to spend his time with. And his parents appear to be somewhat troubled at that as well, knowing that the Israelites were not supposed to intermarry with the Philistines. But nevertheless, they decide to marry Samson to this woman as they find themselves in the vineyards of Timnah in verse 5 of chapter 14. At this point, we see Samson showing his first display of his legendary strength when a young lion comes upon him. And the Spirit of the Lord then comes upon Samson, who tears the lion apart, takes it presumably by its jaws, and with his literally superhuman strength is able to just tear the animal right in two. After this point, we see Samson engaging in a lengthy feud with the Philistines, and especially with some men of his wife's family, and perhaps the villagers that were nearby. After they sort of cheat to solve a riddle that he poses to them, he goes and kills 30 men. Then they come back and decide they're going to get at him, and they burn a home down and instead really end up vexing Samson and inciting him into greater violence. The account in chapter 15 and verse 4 of him finding these 300 foxes, this is just pretty ingenious. We almost have to tip our hat to his creativity, if nothing else. Takes 300 foxes, ties their tails together, puts a torch in between the tails, and ends up creating a good bit of arson as a result of that. But at the climax of this feud, at the end of chapter 15, Samson takes up the jawbone, a fresh jawbone of a donkey. Remember, this is a man who is not supposed to come into contact with anything that is recently dead, any corpses of anything. His weapon of choice in this instance, perhaps out of necessity, he improvises an instrument of war out of a jawbone of a donkey and kills 1,000 men, in verse 15. Kills 1,000 men of the Philistines with that handmade instrument. I've always found myself wondering when you read that account. Number 998, number 999, number 1,000. What were those guys thinking? How big were those men's opinions of themselves that they thought, I know 900 of my buddies just got slaughtered, but I got this. We can take Samson. I don't know how all that worked, if it was one by one, if it was him just cutting a whirlwind through these men. Nevertheless, again, a completely superhuman attack that he engages against the Philistines in. After that point in chapter 16, he sees that things have settled down a bit, perhaps, and goes to Gaza to see a harlot in Gaza. And the Philistines hear that he is in their city, one of their chief cities, the famous Philistine Pentapolis, those five great cities of their region, Gaza being one of them. And so they decide to set an ambush for Samson as he is in visiting this prostitute in their city. He wakes up the next morning, takes the gates of the city itself, which is not just like picking up a door. This is picking up a sizable piece of architecture, of masonry, that he hoists upon his shoulders and runs for some miles away before setting them down. After that showing up the Philistines, in verse 4, Samson meets a new woman. A woman that he meets in the valley of Sorek in chapter 16 in verse 4, which is a small detail that might nonetheless be pertinent. The valley of Sorek translates roughly to being the valley of red grapes. This appears to be a Palestinian wine country of some sort. Again, we wonder, what's Samson, the man who's not supposed to have anything connected with the vine, what's he doing in the valley of red grapes, the valley of Sorek? This woman, Delilah, turns out to be not such a good thing for Samson. I know we have many college kids here whose parents are telling you probably a couple of weeks ago before you left to come back here to College Station, they don't want you meeting the wrong person, falling in love with the wrong person. That guy's trouble. That girl is trouble. You find somebody else to date. I know you think you like her right now. Go with someone else. You don't want to end up with a Delilah. She is bad news from the very beginning for Samson. But what she most wants to do in order to betray him to the Philistines is find out the secret of his strength. What is it that makes Samson so uncannily, so superhumanly strong? And he has several things that he's going to propose to her. They all end up being false. They're all just a bit of deceit that he offers to Delilah to try to tell her how she could take away his strength. Again, we're wondering, how would Samson not be cautious or wary about her motives? Why do you want to know how to take away my strength and bind me so that I can't break free of those things? But on the fourth attempt, Samson does spill the beans entirely and tells her in verse 17, "No razor has ever come upon my head, for I've been a Nazarite to God from my father's womb. If I am shaven, then my strength will leave me, and I shall become weak and be like any other man." Delilah, hearing this, knows that it is the truth, calls the lords of the Philistines, Samson's mortal enemies, cuts his hair, they capture him, they blind him, they humiliate him, put him in prison in Gaza, and bind him in bronze fetters and put him to work grinding, all day doing this slave labor at a grinding wheel, of course, much to the delight of the Philistines. As they gather in their temple, Dagon, in verse 23, holding a festival ceremony that their God, in their opinion, had given them their enemy, Samson, into their hands. Samson is called forth to entertain them. They bring Samson out almost as a party trick. "Call him out in verse 25 that he may perform for us. Let's make sport of him. Let's see this formerly mighty man, the superhuman man with this great strength. Now he's blinded, he's feeble, we've humiliated him thoroughly. Let's bring him out and see what he can do for us to make us laugh." Well, Samson offers this final prayer to the Lord in verse 28, to remember him and to strengthen him, that he might with one blow take vengeance on the Philistines. And then he famously braces himself against the two middle pillars of this temple, pushes them out with his renewed, regained strength given to him by God, causes the entire structure to come down. And we're told in verse 30 that he killed at his death more people than he had killed in his life. He had judged Israel 20 years. We can't see much progress that Israel made during this time, unfortunately. We don't see a lot of leadership, per se, from Samson. And after reading all of his missteps, all of his faults, seeing prostitutes, hanging out with the wine drinkers of the time, coming into contact seemingly consistently, constantly with these dead animals that he was not supposed to as a Nazirite. At least three different times in the story, he's found loitering around an animal carcass somewhere. Despite all of this, as mentioned, we find Samson being called out by name in Hebrews chapter 11, where our writer reaches the point, as he says, that time would fail him to continue telling these stories about individual men and women of faith, and so he simply mentions a few notables by name: Gideon and Barak, Samson and Jephthah, David and Samuel, names that do ring out throughout the Old Testament, the roll call of the faithful. Is it puzzling to us that the Spirit included Samson in such vaunted company? What does that signal about faith and what the true nature of faith really is? I want to consider a few things with you this evening. We'll have five observations and then the lesson will be yours. What does our faith in God mean? What is it? What is it not? I want to first submit that our faith in God does not require perfection. Obviously not, based on the entire list that we read in Hebrews chapter 11, and Samson in particular. But I want to make very clear, when we come across names like this, when we come across examples that are held aloft in the Scriptures, oftentimes it is easy to find fault in some of those men and women. But being a person who walks by faith does not mean that you are a person who is sinless. It does not mean that you have eliminated all your faults and will not fall on occasion. Sometimes fall very hard. Sometimes fall very far. It does not mean that you are without serious shortcomings and limitations in your character. Consider Samson. We've already mentioned a few of the things. He shows a regular disregard for a Nazirite vow that was meant to focus him on godly pursuits. He has a weakness for beautiful women with whom he tends to sin, especially women of the idolatrous foreign kind, the kind that God has warned his people Israel about. He is selfish and flippant. He holds a grudge with the best of them. He answers every problem by punching someone in the face. He's a violent, vengeful person. He has this very bad temper. Most of the time he spends leading Israel does not seem like a high moral character leading the people. It seems more like a guy who's getting into brawls. He's getting into almost drunken-sounding fights with the enemies of the people. But think of the other men in this chapter, too, all throughout Hebrews 11. Noah has a well-publicized bout of drunkenness later in his life. Abraham was not above lying when it suited his purposes. Jacob is a bit of a trickster scoundrel at times. Jacob gets away with a few kind of shady things. Moses committed murder, argued with God about his qualifications. He didn't obey God every single time he was told to do something. Moses is a man who is not without sin. Rahab was a prostitute, at least in her former life. Gideon needed overwhelming proof to believe God. Barak needed a woman around in order for him to fight for God. Jephthah seems to have had a pagan's conception of the Lord and sacrificed his own daughter, a human sacrifice, in a foolish offering. David committed murder to cover up adultery. There are skeletons in all of those closets when we read through Hebrews chapter 11 with a discerning eye. I would stress caution to us when we consider these heroes of the faith, because we can go to two unhealthy extremes. On one end, we have hero worship. We see a man like Moses or Noah or Abraham, a biblical figure whom we deem a good guy early on. And maybe in the children's classes, you know, along the top edge of the wall where some of those faces are presented on a timeline, maybe it's a smiley face. You think of the good kings of Judah. Smiley face. Bad kings get the frown face, right? And so we know who the good guys are. We know which ones are acceptable and approved. And because of that, maybe we excuse all of their behavior. We find weird and contrived and convoluted ways to explain their sins. And we tell our kids in those Bible classes to act exactly like this man. Samson's in Hebrews chapter 11. Be just like him. I think that would be an unhealthy conclusion to reach. On the other end, we run the risk of villainizing men of faith because they were not perfect. We judge them too harshly and, in my estimation, with a degree of arrogance. No one say out loud, of course, but if you were to maybe do a thought exercise, what would your life's story look like, and be honest, if you had an omniscient narrator who's going to write down a couple of chapters to summarize your life, and people are going to be reading about that 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 years after you have died, are you very sure that everyone reading that afterward is going to say, wow, this was a great guy. He had his act together. He never did anything stupid. He never did anything that would bring shame upon God. He was perfect. This man did everything right. My chapter in the book would not look like that. I hope it would leave people with an overall good impression. But I know for a fact there are many things in there that I would be very ashamed of. The point in all of this is that there will only be one perfect example that is found. That will not come until chapter 12. Look unto Jesus. Look unto Christ, the author and finisher of our faith, the writer will tell us. But examples of faith are not meant to be examples of perfect lives. They're examples of real, actual, flesh and blood people. And people do fail. People do foolish things. People do embarrass themselves. Real people do get drunk when they should not. Real people do sleep with people that they should not sleep with. Real people are selfish and violent and vengeful and angry. And while we are on that path of making ourselves resemble that perfect example of Jesus, you just might find yourself being that person who is doing those foolish and embarrassing things. That does not make it okay. Please don't misunderstand me. It just makes it the reality. And it doesn't mean that you have no faith in God when you sin. I should hope not, because everyone here would have lost their faith many times over, probably every day of our lives. When we call ourselves people with faith in God, and when we strive to be people who live by faith, please don't think that is a substitute, that is a code word for saying, I'm going to be a Christian, that means I'm going to be perfect. I have faith in God, that means I can't ever fall. And when I do, there's no getting back to being a person of faith. Faith is not for the perfect. It is for those who recognize that they have, in fact, sinned. I would go on to say that having faith in God does not even mean that your faith itself is perfect. Not only are the lives of the faithful sometimes lacking, but even that confidence in God can sometimes fall short. We have to notice, if you turn back with me to Judges, and what might be Samson's two greatest shining moments. Let's look first at chapter 15. Judges 15, beginning in verse 18. This is after Samson has slaughtered 1,000 Philistines. He has done the act for which he is maybe the most famous. He has, for the first time perhaps, made a noticeable dent in the Lord's enemies, and has actually done something substantive in the land of Israel, perhaps. Right after this moment, here is Samson at his most faithful in verse 18. Afterward, he became very thirsty. So he cried out to the Lord and said, "You have given this great deliverance by the hand of your servant. And now shall I die of thirst and fall into the hand of the uncircumcised?" So God split the hollow place that is in Lehi. Water came out and he drank, and his spirit returned and he revived. Here is Samson acknowledging that it is God who has given the deliverance. He is acknowledging in full the fact that God is the one who is fighting. God is the one supplying the power. This is Samson acting and speaking with faith. But do you notice even in that prayer, maybe an undue concern for self? Maybe a bit of petulance almost. Yeah, you were with me now, but are you going to take care of me now? I'm thirsty. I need you to help me out. We see this same focus on self in chapter 16, what we read a moment ago in verse 28, the final moment of Samson's life, where again he is going to recognize and acknowledge it is only the power of God that will equip him to do anything. But even in calling to the Lord, in verse 28 of chapter 16, O Lord God, remember me, I pray. Strengthen me, I pray. Just this once, O God, that I may with one blow take vengeance on the Philistines for my two eyes. Here is Samson in the midst of a pagan worship service to the god Dagon, where the Philistines are boasting and crowing over their victory. Really, essentially, they're celebrating this as a victory over Jehovah, a victory over his champion. We're stronger than he is. We're stronger than they are. Samson is not worried about that. He's not worried about how poorly he has done in leading God's people, how much potential he has squandered. He's instead concerned about the fact that they wronged him. They blinded me, and I want vengeance for that. Even here, in this moment of faith, some more sense of self creeping in. His reliance on God is inconsistent. It wavers. Sometimes it appears to be a total afterthought. But I think often of that poor father in Mark chapter 9. That poor father whose child Jesus healed. He had a demon that was an evil spirit of some sort that was plaguing him for years. Jesus offered to the man, explained to the man, I can help if you believe. The man says, Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief. A faith that acknowledges it is lacking sometimes. Is your faith right now as strong as it can be? Is your faith in God right now as strong as it will be? I hope we would all answer to that second question, no. No, I hope not. I hope to continue to grow in my confidence in God, my trust in Him, my reliance upon Him. I don't want my faith to stagnate. I certainly don't want it to shrink. It must be growing. Well, that allows for the possibility then that it is imperfect right now. I might lack in some things. Do you ever waver in your conviction? Have you ever doubted or questioned or wondered? Things of eternal significance, things of spiritual significance. Those aren't necessarily signs of faithlessness. They're signs of being someone with room to grow in their faith. In other words, congratulations. They're signs that you are a human being. That you might have growth to do. That you are in fact a real person. Who right now is not where you need to be. Not who you need to be. If we identify ourselves as people who live by faith, as people who recognize what Hebrews chapter 11 is talking about and what that asks of us and demands of us, that is not saying, I've arrived completely. I have this completed and fully matured and well-seasoned faith that has grown up in all of its entirety to what and to whom and to where I need to be. We instead must recognize that some of these men who are held aloft as examples for us, they had their moments of weakness, even in their confidence in God. They had their moments where they were not who they should have been. We also must say that faith does not guarantee our survival of every trial that we face. In this 11th chapter of Hebrews, Samson does have an interesting distinction relative to the rest of the list preceding him. As far as I can determine here, he is the only one specifically named in the chapter who dies in the very moment of carrying out an act of faith. Samson, when the temple falls around him, when he pushes the pillars out and the structure collapses and he dies in the debris, in the ruins, he is at that moment acting out his faith in Jehovah. And he dies as an immediate and direct result of what he is doing. The other men who are mentioned in Hebrews chapter 11, well, Abel, maybe we could say, dies as an indirect result of his sacrifice of faith. The patriarchs all face their deaths with great confidence and trust in God. But all those first men that we read about were victorious because of their faith. And those are the Old Testament stories we like reading. And finding as the examples to follow, right? Moses, a man of faith. He led Israel out of Egypt. No one knew greater successes than Moses. The Exodus, the plagues, crossing the Red Sea, fighting against their early enemies as a people and destroying them with the Lord's help. Moses was a winner. Moses got things done and succeeded. The other judges, Gideon, Barak, Jephthah, those guys won their fights. They went out to battle. They destroyed their enemies. They came back home and they lived peaceful lives. And then, as far as we can tell, just did what we all want to do. They died in their beds at old age, surrounded by friends and family. They had peaceful lives. They won with the help of God. David secures the golden age of Israel through numerous successes in his life. David, it seems, had very few truly bad days, especially after he becomes king of Israel. I know he had his share of hardship and sorrow, but his wealth, his happiness, his close relationship to God, victory against enemies on all sides. David knows success. And when he cries out to the Lord in a difficulty, he survives and he thrives and he gets stronger. But Samson, in the moment where he most vividly expresses his faith in the Lord, is buried under the rubble of a Philistine temple where his life ends. He trusted God to do what was needed, and he still died in that very same moment. Of course, others who are alluded to in Hebrews 11, but not named, would be much the same. If we continue our reading past verse 32 in Hebrews 11, you see a reference to some of the prophets, to those who were sawn in two, those who were stoned to death, those who were tortured to death. But we kind of shrink back for a moment and say, but wait a minute, especially in the Old Testament, isn't that what faith does? Aren't we protected from harm when we trust God? Isn't that what keeps us out of all that trouble? Having confidence that He'll do that and get me out of that jam? One of the most profound statements of faith that I can find in all of the Scriptures is made by the three friends of Daniel. If you look in the third chapter of the book of Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, threatened by King Nebuchadnezzar with the death of the furnace, a painful death of being burned alive, is looming over these men's heads if they do not fall down and worship the image that Nebuchadnezzar, the king of all Babylon, has erected in his honor. And he gives the men a second chance. Okay, boys, I know you heard that music, and I know you know what to do when you hear the music strike up. You fall down and worship the image. Now, take two. Are you going to do differently? I saw that you were not bowing the first time. Their response, beginning in verse 16, is truly beautiful. O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter. If it be so that you throw us into the furnace, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire, and He will deliver us out of your hand, O King. But even if He does not, let it be known to you, O King, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Even if. That is true faith. That is true reliance on God. I know He can. I know His power. But even if we die here today, we're not going to betray Him. We are not going to go back on our God. Brethren, I know you know this. And I know this church, this group of people, has experienced this seemingly repeatedly over the last couple of years. We are not promised deliverance from everything we will have to face in this life. Not physically, at least. You may not ever get relief from that chronic pain that you feel. You may, in fact, die of that illness you have just been diagnosed with. Your home, as we're seeing many in the Houston area where I've come up from, your home may not survive that flood. Those waters may take away everything you have. You might lose your job and not be able to find a new one. Faith means that we trust in God's power to save if it is His will, and we trust in His wisdom when He decides not to do so, and we trust in His grace to ultimately save our souls, no matter what this life brings against us, which is ultimately of greatest importance. Do not fall into the trap of the deception that says, if I live by faith in God, everything is going to go well for me. I'm going to recover every time. My loved ones are going to be safe. I'll never face pain. I'll never face hardship. I'll always win. Well, God's people do win the final battle, the final war, we might say. We might lose some physical battles. What does faith do then on the positive side? What can we say about it assertively? The faith of God's people is an extremely powerful thing. Even in the smallest doses. What does Jesus say to His wavering disciples in Matthew 17 and verse 20? Truly I say to you, if you have faith the size of a mustard seed. Maybe you've seen a mustard seed. It looks like a little black grain, like a piece of uncracked pepper maybe. Just a little tiny seed. If you have that tiny degree of faith, you will say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move. And nothing will be impossible to you. Samson seems to have had just a little bit of faith. But didn't a little bit go a long way? Samson is unique and interesting to me among biblical characters. Other men that we see in the Scriptures work miracles that are quite outside of themselves. Kind of intangible almost. Moses maybe does something with his staff and something happens. Or Elijah says something and something causes a reaction because of that. There's no real physical display. Some of them do courageous things in battle, but they're mostly within the confines of human possibility. Samson, on the other hand, is this very clear, strong man figure. He's an archetype, and one that has always been and probably always will be just very appealing to humankind. Think of the Greeks with their Achilles and Hercules and Theseus and these great powerful men who could rip animals in half and who could push pillars down and who could do all these amazing things. You think of today. I don't see any here right now. Someone probably is wearing a Superman undershirt or something. You'll pull that off when you get home so you feel cool. But we still think of Superman, Wonder Woman, people who have this impressive physical strength. I can remember when I was a kid in the 1980s. Some of you might remember hearing of the Power Team. Do you remember the Power Team? Those kind of goofy guys who would go around like blowing up the hot water heater bottles and breaking blocks of ice and running through concrete walls or whatever it was that they would be doing. There's something about a real, raw, simple act of pure physical strength that, as humans, innately, it captures our imagination. There's something about that, just seeing someone do something, displaying his physical strength, brute strength, that is just impressive to us. It just captures our imagination. It's a vivid thing to us. I would be of the opinion, I'll only offer this as an opinion, but I seem to think that God is very intentionally, in this case, using this type of man, this type of force, where Samson becomes really a living parable to us. We all want to be stronger, or men do at least. I don't really see a lot of women, really jacking heavy weight around in the weight room, trying to build mass and do things like that. Maybe some of you are, and more power to you. But that's something that men, we drink protein shakes and go to the weight room often and try to increase our strength. That's something that we want to do. I guess we lift weights so that we can go and lift heavier weights. I'm not quite firm on the end goal of all of that. But nevertheless, we want to do it. We want to get stronger. Strength is appealing. We see its utility. We're innately impressed by displays of great strength. Here, God's chosen deliverer exhibits literally superhuman strength, doing things that no man before or since could actually do. The focus, though, is not meant to be on the feats themselves. We see Samson ripping a lion in half, breaking the bonds, the shackles that are put on him, tearing down a building with one blow. That's not really what the focus is. Those things are the shadow. They're the illustration. They're the story part of the parable, not its meaning. It's simply one more instance of God displaying how great His power is relative to ours. Man can build a house. God created the universe. Man can make fire if he rubs sticks together or hits flint on something. God can send fire from nowhere to destroy sticks and stones and water and bones. Man can look after the sick and help him out with chemicals and wound treatment. God can resurrect from the dead. And yes, man might be able to build muscles and move weights and increase his max on bench press. But God's strong man rips things in half as though they were nothing. Tears down buildings with a single surge of strength. Lifts city gates up onto his shoulders and runs miles with them. You can't keep up with God's strength. You can't put in that day in the gym that Samson is going to be able to do. Why is he choosing this raw, visceral strength? To show us how powerful he really is, just in one more dimension. We can rely on our own strength. That's an option that's available to us in every realm of life, but God consistently shows that his power outstrips ours exponentially. There's no comparison. We see the people in Samson's time who are in awe of him. The very fact that the people are coming to Delilah saying, find out what his secret is. How is he doing it? Because it doesn't compute to us. That's the power of God. A final consideration this evening. That meant I have 5 minutes, right? Okay. Final thought for this evening. For all his faults, at the end of the day, Samson is one who believed that God was with him and that God was the source of his great power. He defeats 1,000 Philistines and acknowledges that it was the Lord who, as he says in his own words, had given this great deliverance. He knows Samson didn't do that. I'm not just that skilled with a jawbone. I'm not just that good and that strong and that perfect. God gave this great deliverance. He keeps the secret to his strength from Delilah for a while because he knows there is a secret to his strength. He is not really just that strong. It's not something he innately possesses. It's a result of his relationship to God. And he seeks vengeance upon his enemies at the end of his life and prays to the Lord. He requires God's strength and not his own. He doesn't try to, first of all, go up to those pillars and say, oh, see what I can do? I mean, I've done this kind of thing before. Maybe I can tackle this one. No, he says, I'm going to need God for this. He is the true power. Having faith doesn't mean we won't sin. Doesn't mean we will never waver. Doesn't mean we'll have happy and healthy and successful lives on this earth. Having faith simply means that we acknowledge the power and goodness of God, that we lean on Him completely to deliver our souls from death. And our faith being placed in Christ, who's offered Himself as a sacrifice for us, means that we place our faith in Him, in His ability to save and to deliver in the end, in finality, to give us life. Samson does have his shortcomings, but he is a man who believes that God can do what he has promised, that God, if he chooses, can supply whatever power, whatever strength, whatever force is needed. And we do need to have that same confidence in God, even now. I thank you very much for your time this evening.